Welcome to the Fair Talks podcast, where we educate everyday people for extraordinary change. I'm your host, Alicia Chan, Executive Director of Fairtrade LA, a community of business members, nonprofits, and fair trade enthusiasts driving proactive, sustainable solutions for a fairer world. I'm also a social entrepreneur with a passion for ending poverty and creating dignified jobs. Together, we'll explore how fair trade changes lives and communities and what we can do to address some of the world's biggest problems right in our own homes. Let's dive in. Fair Talks is brought to you by Fairtrade USA, the organization that brings you the Fair Trade Certified label. Fairtrade USA is committed to building an innovative model of responsible business, conscious consumerism, and shared value to eliminate poverty and enable sustainable development for farmers, workers, their families, and communities around the world. Shoes. Have you ever thought about how your shoes were made? When I pause and think about just how many different types of shoes there are, I realize just how complicated this industry is. I mean, just me personally, I have sandals, flats, sneakers, heels, boots, and we can break those down even further, but I'll stop there. Think about it. The details that go into each type of shoe for it to serve its particular purpose, as well as being stylish in design, and most importantly, at least to me, comfort. My shoes have to be comfortable. I've learned over the years through some of my own poor decisions how important it is to have good shoes. I'm sure I'm not the only one who has sacrificed comfort for style and later regretted it. Shoes are the most important part of your outfit. Our shoes will impact our overall health, including our backs, our joints, and how we support our body throughout the day. I've definitely learned my lesson in the importance of investing in good shoes. Now, besides style and comfort, do you ever stop and think about who made your shoes? I believe it was in the 1990s when the American athletic footwear company Nike made headlines for its sweatshop scandal, which exposed that Nike was making their shoes in sweatshops using child labor in multiple countries in Asia. In the film Behind the Swoosh, they revealed how workers were being paid $1.25 per day. And Life magazine, in 1996, published a shocking photo of a 12-year-old Pakistani boy sewing a Nike soccer ball, all while consumers are paying $100 to $200 per pair of Nike sneakers in the mall. On this podcast, we have discussed the importance of farmers behind the food we consume and makers behind our clothes and jewelry. But today, I am so honored to be able to shine a light on shoemakers. For the first time, we are interviewing a fair trade shoe company from Guatemala called The Root Collective. They partner with small independent workshops to handcraft their gorgeous shoes and bags. Today, we have with us Bethany Trang, the founder of The Root Collective. Bethany is a problem solver. She left a stable career in marketing to start The Root Collective because the lack of jobs in underserved communities wasn't being addressed. She believes that commerce can change the world, that women are a key part of that, and that every single person has the power to create a better future. She's a Forbes-featured women entrepreneur and lives in Raleigh, North Carolina with her husband, son, and two dogs. Bethany is giving our listeners 20% off their entire collection, so make sure to stick around until the end to get your exclusive discount code. Now, let's dive in.
Hi, Bethany. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I can tell that The Root Collective is truly a labor of love for you, a place where you are truly living out your calling, which I completely connect with in my own life. Yeah. But before we get started talking about this awesome company, you spent 12 years in the marketing world, including working for a Fortune 500 company. I'm sure there's just so much to dive into there, but can you tell us what that past life of yours looked like? Was it what you expected as like a successful career, or at least what the world would call it? And what's your greatest takeaway from that part of your life?
Oh gosh. Yeah. By the time I left corporate, it was definitely, I would say, what the outside world would call a successful career. And, you know, at the time, what you think you're supposed to be going after. I'd started my last corporate job, I'm going to say 3 or 4 months before I started actively working on The Root Collective. So the two kind of went hand in hand. I actually think it was a kind of a big catalyst for me deciding to move out of the corporate world. You know, it was, you know, here I've made it. I was working, I mean, it was a Fortune 50 company, massive company.
Wow.
Downtown Philadelphia, you know, working on the 40th floor. Like I have made it. Right.
Wow, yeah. Yes. Right. That sounds like the dream job for most people.
Yes. It was a very hard company to get into, to the point that, like, when I got fired, I had past colleagues reaching out to me going, how did you get in? Like, I've been trying to get into this company for years. How did you get in? Especially because I didn't have a master's degree. And apparently, like, getting hired there without a master's degree was almost impossible. And I have never cried faster at a job. I was miserable.
Wow. Like, oh my goodness.
Full, like, why am I here? So that was definitely a big sign that, like, I don't think this is really where I'm supposed to be. But I mean, you know, every job that I had from, you know, being in college and after, you know, you always, it kind of builds, you know, and I was in marketing and, you know, I joke that was the only thing that I knew going into starting the Root Collective. It's really not a joke. I literally didn't know how to do anything else, but it really did give me a solid backbone, you know, with at least that small, I mean, marketing is not a small piece, but like that piece of business ownership. So I definitely don't regret any of those jobs at all. You know, I really think that they, you know, from a professional standpoint, really made me into somebody who at least had at least a little bit of an idea of what they were doing. Not much, but a little bit of an idea.
It prepared you. It prepared you.
Yes.
Somewhat.
Yes.
Now, I'm curious, what brought you to Guatemala in the first place? And out of everything that comes out of Guatemala, what made you dive into shoes? And then, like, how did you come up with the idea and the name, the Root Collective?
Yeah. So friends of mine had actually started a nonprofit that worked in a slum in Guatemala City. And so that was my connection there. I had never traveled, well, except for Canada, which barely counts. I had never traveled outside the country at that point. And I was, let me see, first time I went to Guatemala, I mean, I was mid-20s. Somewhere around there. So one of my close friends was one of the founding members of this nonprofit, and she was moving to Guatemala for a year. And the second she told me this, I mean, it was immediate. I'm going to come visit you. Like, I just, you know, those moments where you just know, like, this is what I'm supposed to do.
Yeah.
That's what it was. She did not believe me. She was like, there's no way you're coming.
Yeah.
And sure enough, I mean, that was like September, October, and then Valentine's Day the following year, I landed in Guatemala City and just spent a week, you know, hanging out in the slum with her and coming face to face with true poverty for the first time, which, you know, I think is, I mean, I did not grow up with a lot of money at all. You know, we were lower middle class, but, you know, we always had food on the table and, you know, shoes on our feet and things like that. But, you know, really just having that kind of exposure.
Yeah.
I was pretty shook. shook coming home. And I ended up going back down to Guatemala multiple times over the next few years. And I would say the idea for the Root Collective really was planted on that first trip because I realized very quickly that there was like this micro economy that was happening within the slum. And I had asked my friend about it. And she was basically like, you can't get a job if you live here. Like, no one will hire you simply because of where you live. Like, people will literally lie about their address on job applications. And this was just mind-blowing to me. And also looking at, I'm always like, try to be very careful when I say this because I don't ever want to like sound like I'm coming down on nonprofits that are like going after poverty alleviation. But to me, it was like, why aren't we empowering the parents to be able to like take care of their kids rather than coming in with charity?
Yes.
Simply because it's like, if money was going to solve poverty, it would have by now. Like, you can't just keep throwing money at something. Like, you know, the Salvation Army has been going after poverty alleviation since the 1800s, and we're still here. And that's not to say that those efforts don't make a difference, because I know for sure that they do, but it just kind of seemed backwards to me. Like, we're really going after this backwards.
I guess I put it as so many people are investing in short-term solutions and no one's willing to invest in long-term solutions, which Absolutely. Is jobs for the parents.
Yep. Yeah, it's literally you're putting a Band-Aid on something that needs exactly. major surgery. And so it was, that became, you know, and it was funny because it was not, this business wasn't even, I never thought I'd be an entrepreneur. It's not like I was like looking for business opportunities. But it was interesting how much it stood out to me. So over the next couple of years, this idea just kind of grew and grew and grew as I was going down there. And to answer your question about how we ended up in shoes, that was definitely not on purpose. I have no background in shoes whatsoever, except for knowing I'm a size 6 and that, you know, shoes go on my feet. That was about the extent of it. But we had ended up getting connected as all of this was happening, like figuring out the business model and, you know, having that epiphany that this was what I was supposed to do. I had ended up getting connected with a shoemaker. And when we launched, we were actually doing multiple things. We were doing some jewelry and some bags and some scarves, and shoes were like an afterthought. Like we launched with one style in 4 different colors. Like this was not what we were going to do. But as things just kind of, you know, we launched the business and as things started growing over the next year, and I would say first year and a half, like that was the thing that caught people's attention because it was unique. Like at the time, you know, in the fair trade world, you know, we recently became a member of the Fair Trade Federation, but you know, we were still a fair trade business without the official label.
Right.
You know, at the time there was Feel Goods. I think Nisolo had just started. Feel Goods only does flip-flops, you know, not like a full-blown shoe company. I think Nisolo may have been around for a year or two. I didn't even know that they existed at the time. So, but you know, you had all these other like major big fair trade companies that were doing the jewelry and doing the bags, and they were doing it really well. So that was kind of like, for people in the fair trade world, it wasn't anything interesting. So the shoes were the thing that ended up sticking. And we eventually just niched down into that. And, you know, here we are 10 plus years later. doing shoes, shoes.
I connect with your story so much because, I kind of graduated and did not, like, even though I came from a business family, I was like, I'm not going to do business. I'm just going to find a comfortable job because I knew how crazy the business world was. But it's like, once you see the need and you see solutions, it's like that carries you. It's like, you can't say no. But props to you though, because when I was exploring different artisans and different makers in Haiti, I stopped at a shoemaker and he showed me the whole process. And immediately I was like, this is way too complicated.
That's because you're smart. I had years ago, years ago, somebody had come to me. She was looking to start, it was a similar company over, I think it was actually in the Middle East. And so she's asking me like what she needs to know to start a shoe company. And I'm like, literally do anything else, anything else. This is so hard. Do anything else.
Oh yeah, it is. I can't even imagine all the details you have to think about.
Yeah.
Now we were kind of joking earlier about how, you know, you're saying all you knew was marketing, but the reality is marketing is such a crucial piece to a small business. So crucial. So I am curious, what did you learn from the marketing world that you brought into your fair trade company? And like, what marketing advice would you give now to all the fair trade companies out there?
I think that my previous corporate experience, one of the biggest things was honestly like the website side of things. Like that was something that I became more comfortable with and running, because we're fully e-commerce, running that side of things for other companies really just gave me a more solid understanding and like opportunities to do things like, you know, I went for like a Google Analytics training, which is completely useless now. Like it's changed so much. It's not even funny, but you know, just having those things, I could, you know, do a little bit of coding. I joke that I know just enough to like really break my website, which is very true, but you know, getting those things, because my degree was not in marketing. So like, I didn't really have the theoretical side of things going into the business. I really do think that it made a big impact on you know, being able to do what I'm doing now. Now, in terms of marketing advice for other fair trade companies, I think there's, you know, there's two big things that we've really tried to do. And the first one of those is like really dignified storytelling. We have seen, and I'm not even thinking of like a particular brand right now. So like, you know, people don't listen to this and be like, who's talking about, because I'm not talking about anybody specific, but you know, people kind of taking the Humane Society, Sarah McLachlan, Arms of an Angel approach to their marketing, where it's just very sad and guilt ridden, I guess. Or on the other side of that is like really exploiting artisan stories, you know, all the bad things that have happened to them. And to me, that's guilt marketing. And I don't want somebody to buy from me because they feel bad. You know, I want them to buy from me, number one, because they love the product. Like if you're not going product first, then there is a problem with your marketing. You have to compete with all the other big brands that are out there from a design perspective. You know, if it's wearable, for comfortability, like all of those things, you have to be competing with the big companies out there. But also just, you know, we never use the word help. We don't talk about helping people. We don't talk about people in need. We don't talk about anything like that, because, you know, when I'm thinking about how would I want somebody to talk about me? Like, I wouldn't want somebody to be like, oh yeah, she really needs help. She needs somebody to buy this because she needs help. And I'm like, that's not, like, that doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel good to me. So with other fair trade companies, like really thinking about, you know, making sure that you're telling the stories with dignity, telling the stories in a way that is going to be uplifting to your makers, to your artisans. And also, you know, one of the other big things is like sustainability now. So many companies are talking about, you know, more ethical practices, and it's becoming less of a something that's going to separate you as a brand. And so future-proofing yourself and your marketing that, you know, hopefully in 10, 15 years from now, like fair trade is going to be normal. Like, and it should be, like, that should be business as usual. So we're always thinking of that too, like still having the humanistic side to our marketing and still telling those stories, but also making sure that that's not all that we're doing.
So many practical tips there. I'm learning as you're sharing too. Thank you. You're the first fair trade shoe company that we interviewed. And like we said, I can't even imagine how complicated this industry is. But you have sneakers, flats, sandals, heels. I feel like they're all in itself like a whole different like research process. And people always brag about how comfortable they are. So it's beyond research. You have to like put it into practice. So can you bring me and our audience into the shoe world? What are the different steps to creating a pair of shoes, the fabric, the leather, the sole of the shoes? Like bring us into your production world.
It is a complicated one, that's for sure. So the life cycle of a shoe, we normally start, so like if we're, you know, we're designing something new, we're doing something brand new, you know, we always just start looking for inspiration. Like what we typically will have an idea, like, okay, we, you know, we want to do a sandal, we want to do a heel, we want to do whatever. So we start looking for inspiration of things that we like, silhouettes that we like, you know, because they're just, even the slope of the top of a shoe can completely change how it looks. So we start looking at, you know, silhouettes. What are things that we particularly like about this? What don't we like about this? And just look at what else is out there on the marketplace. And then from there, I work with my co-designer, because I can't draw. I can draw stick people. That's about it. And she is a very good artist. So she'll normally, our joke is that I'll send her something. I'm like, okay, so I kind of want it like this, but like actually nothing like this at all. But I want you to like start with this.
Transform it for me.
And so from there, we go back and forth, because we have a, so I'm in Raleigh, North Carolina. We do have, I have one local person here, but my designer is in Oklahoma. So, you know, her and I just, we communicate over email, and we Marco Polo a ton. And so we just kind of narrow things down. You know, we go through different versions and variations of the sketches that she's doing. And then once we have what we want, gets turned into a tech pack, which is basically, let's give them as much information as we possibly can. So like, here are different angles of the shoe. Here's the slope of things that we want. There are times that we're like sending actual measurements. Most of the time we're kind of like the first time around, we're not sending them full measurements because we are not the shoemakers. Like, we're the designers. We're not necessarily as much on the technical side. And then from there it is, you know, okay, well, what type of leather do we want to use? Because different leathers are going to react different ways. You know, you've got a nubuck versus a smooth leather versus this leather that we typically use is a little bit thinner. It's going to stretch a little bit more. This one's a little bit thicker. So we're not going to have as much give with it. And we actually have learned to, like, when we're sampling things, we sample it with our thinnest, softest leather and our thickest, hardest leather to like understand how that fit, because you're using the same, the mold that shoes are made on is called a last. You're using that same last regardless of the leather. And so, you know, the way that we like to explain this to people is I buy mostly Madewell jeans, but it's like, depending on the fabric content, like if it has less stretch, if it has more stretch, if it's a little bit thinner, if it's a little bit thicker, I can be 2 to 3 totally different sizes in those jeans. And it's the same thing with shoes, except, you know, a little bit more complicated because you've got literally a millimeter, which is tiny, can completely change the fit of a shoe. It's nuts.
So interesting.
So anyway, once we have like the basis of the design, then it's like, okay, can we use an existing sole that we have right now? Can we use an existing last that we have right now? Or do we have to figure it out? Most of our soles are made in Guatemala, where we are literally developing the soles with this company. Like, it's not something that they just sell off the shelf. We are developing the sole with the company. Our most recent sneaker, our Alex sneaker, which just came out at the end of last year, that sole comes from Mexico, but like we had to find it. Like, we had to find some place in Mexico that had a sole that was similar to what we liked. And then from there, all this stuff goes to our shoemaker, and they're making a lot of decisions on the go, and we use WhatsApp with them. So sometimes, you know, we're going back and forth with questions where like they're doing a sample and they'll send us pictures and it's like, okay, well, that doesn't look quite right. Like, so let's try this. Let's maybe move this piece over here, you know, and once we get through that process, then we always sample. So I'm a size 6, which is actually sample size. So in shoemaking, if you're going to be making a sample, just in general, it's a size 6, which works out well. So then it comes to me, and we have, I don't think, ever gotten it right on the first try.
I bet.
So most of the time it is 4+ samples going back and forth of just, okay, well, we need to take this piece down 3 millimeters. We need to move this piece over here 2 millimeters. So once we get that first sample, then we start really getting to the nitty gritty of like, what the measurements need to be specifically for a size 6, which will then be scaled. So once we have a fit sample that is approved, then at that point, you know, they go into pattern making where they're scaling the patterns for the different sizes. We're getting the, we work with a company in Guatemala to get the lasts made. You know, we're sourcing whatever other materials we need. Like, so the soles from Mexico. Okay. So at that point we're ordering the soles from Mexico and getting them delivered into Guatemala. There are a lot of different components that go on. So we have a manager in Guatemala who is, he's really kind of the one responsible for sourcing all of these different things. And then at that point, you know, once we're there, we go into production. And sometimes we go into production and then like something has changed and suddenly the shoe isn't quite fitting the same way as it was when it was approved, because we've got one specific person making the samples and the patterns. But then once it goes into production, it's like you change one tiny thing that, you know, nobody really realized is being changed. And now all of a sudden there's a problem.
We have had this
happen more than once.
My mom owned a factory, so I know the difference between the sample room and the production side. There's a big gap there.
Yes, there definitely can be.
Before we dive back into today's episode, let's take a moment to shine a spotlight on something truly remarkable. Did you know that the Root Collective is a proud member of the Fair Trade Federation? The Fair Trade Federation, or the FTF, is an inspiring trade association comprised of verified fair trade enterprises. These enterprises are deeply committed to fostering equitable and sustainable trading partnerships. Grounded in community values, they work tirelessly to support and strengthen one another, all while advancing a global movement in trade, one that values the health of the planet and the labor and dignity and quality of all people. Being a part of this vibrant community of fair trade enterprises comes with numerous benefits. So if you're an entrepreneur yourself running a social enterprise and eager to get involved, visit the membership section at fairtradefederation.org to discover what it takes to become verified yourself. Did you know that the Fair Trade Federation just had their 30th anniversary conference and expo in the vibrant city of Richmond, Virginia last week? 46 different verified fair trade enterprises showcased their products and stories at the expo, which is unlike any other event in the U.S. and Canada. If you weren't able to join this event, no worries. There's going to be so much more to come from the Fair Trade Federation in 2024. So be sure to visit thefairtradefederation.org for details and sign up for the newsletter to stay in the loop. All right, let's get back to the episode.
As a consumer, as a female who, you know, shoes is always hard to find where it doesn't like hurt your feet. I'm curious, what are the difference between the soles of like a sneaker, which is like very comfortable, versus sandals, which I've seen in your, on your shoes, it's not just completely flat, like most sandals. And then the heel, the heels, which have like a piece of wood, right? Mm-hmm. Like, can you educate us on the difference?
Yeah. So our sneaker soles, so we have currently have two different soles for sneakers. So the Alex is literally something that we were able to source from Mexico, which was glorious because we didn't have to do anything. We're like, here's a sole.
Yeah.
Put it on a shoe. Our sneaker sole for the Jessie and the Sabrina. So those are totally different style, but they use the same sole. You know, like that was something that we had to work with the factory on developing because they had never done anything like that. I hate most sandals because they are so uncomfortable. They have no support. There's no cushion. There's just like, blah. And I was real big on like, we're going to have to figure this out because I'm not going to put a shoe out in the marketplace that I don't want to wear.
Right.
And I have gone, I mean, I do my research, right? So I'm going to Macy's and DSW and trying things on. And, you know, like you put a pair of Jack Rogers sandals on your feet, which are not cheap. These are not cheap shoes. I'm like, they're so uncomfortable. They're just flat. There's nothing to them. So with our sandals specifically, you know, leather and rubber are two things that we can pretty easily get in Guatemala. Rubber is actually natively grown in Guatemala. So that comes, we work directly with a rubber factory for that. And then the way that we designed the insole was to have a little bit of cushion. So our leather and rubber sole is actually very comfortable. And then you add in that little bit of insole cushion. I can wear them for hours. And they're great on my feet. Like I don't feel like I'm just like standing on concrete, which is how I feel in like other sandals. And then our heels, that was really interesting because for the most part in Guatemala, if you want to do a heel, it's going to be plastic. Like that's what you have access to. And I'm like, well, that doesn't really look very nice. And we also, as much as we can, being in the shoe industry, you're pretty much never going to, I shouldn't say never, going to be very, very hard to get rid of plastics. So like all of our like foams and stuff like that, that's going to be plastics based. There are other options out there, but it is so insanely expensive and we would have to like hire a lab to make it for us. Not going to happen right now.
Yeah.
So like we do try to really be mindful of how much plastic we're using. So I didn't want to use like a plastic heel. So we got connected with someone who worked with wood and we're like, let's see if we can do this. So we worked with him on developing that. And, you know, we were like, here's the shape that we want. And he did a really great job. He works with our sole factory. So he'll do like the wood portion and then it gets sent to the sole factory where they finish it off. But yeah, that was developing that sole specifically was, that was a lot.
Yeah.
There's just so many moving parts to it.
Yeah. The heels are beautiful though. I've seen them.
Thank you.
So beautiful.
Thank you.
That's so interesting. I just learned so much about shoes. I think our audience would appreciate that too. And now I will never look at a shoe the same again. I will appreciate every piece of it.
As you should. It's the most complicated thing that you wear by far. Yeah. They're so complicated.
And the older you get, the more you realize shoes are so crucial. Like if you wear the wrong shoes, it messes up your whole body and it's so,
so true.
Crucial. Yeah.
So true.
So I know the Root Collective really focuses on like sustainability and sustainable models. And something that is very unique to the shoe industry is that you have a pre-ordering model, like you pre-order your shoes online. I love that it promotes slow fashion. And the lead time is not that long for it being made all the way in Guatemala. And then on the website, you also sell pre-loved shoes on your site, which is so innovative. So yeah, can you tell us more about the importance of sustainability in your business model and how you try to implement that into your company?
Yeah, we decided to go, we started experimenting with pre-order years ago, where we would like do a launch on pre-order. And I think it was, I guess probably about 2.5 years ago, we decided to really start leaning into it for a few reasons. And, you know, one of those is when we're ordering inventory, you know, there would be a lot of times where it's like, we'd have an order for a shoemaker's and then, well, we don't really need anything from you for the next couple of weeks. So, you know, so sorry, we can't place an order because we don't need to restock anything else right now. So we were looking at it in two ways of number one, trying to keep them a little bit more consistently busy where we'd be able to place an order basically every week. But the other thing is that in the fashion industry specifically, overproduction is one of the biggest issues. Pretty much every brand out there is going to overproduce something. And we're a small brand and there were times that we overproduced, you know, a color that we thought was going to go really well. And now all of a sudden we're stuck here with these shoes that aren't selling. And I was like, this really just, it doesn't make sense for like from a sustainability standpoint. Also for a small business, our biggest risk is inventory. For any small business, if you're doing product, your biggest risk is inventory. And I mean, it is a massive expense. And if you're not moving it quickly, because, you know, any product-based business's goal is to be zero inventory, where you're bringing something in and it's turning around and selling right away, which is going to happen for no one. I mean, that's, you basically can't do that. So we had seen some other brands doing pre-order on a limited basis and that it was working really well for them. And we're like, let's try this. So we did it on a launch or two and it went really well. And then about two years ago, we're like, let's just fully switch to this and just kind of see what happens. You know, from a sustainability standpoint, from a standpoint of our shoemakers, we love it. We know that it does scare off some new customers because they don't want to wait. You know, we have very much still the general population is very Amazon mindset. And I mean, I live very close to an Amazon fulfillment center and I get angry sometimes because I'll order something and it's at my door 2 hours later. And I'm like, you are ruining it for everyone. Ruining it for everyone. So much of the general public is still in this, like, I want it and I want it now. I'm sure there are times where it's like, you do legitimately need something, you know, like you were supposed to be leaving on a trip and your last flip-flop broke and you need it now, you know, things like that do happen. But I think really like for us, we're not going after the mass market. Like I would much rather be a smaller cult brand than be the next golden goose. You know, we don't need to be this massive company. So it has been working for us and most of our customers are very on board with it. They understand why we're doing it. And then our pre-loved section, which we call the Root Seller. When did we start that? A year and a half ago, maybe? Really just wanting more circularity. So with the Root Seller, which is our pre-loved platform, we really wanted to, you know, have more circularity in our business model, because I mean, I'm sure you can relate to this where it's like you buy something, you'll wear it a lot. And then all of a sudden you're just not reaching for it much anymore. And then what happens to those items? You know, either they get tossed, which is a waste, or they get sent to a thrift store, which is also usually a waste because such a small portion of what gets sent to thrift stores actually ends up getting sold. So we had a buy sell group on Facebook for our customers for a long time.
You guys do have a big fan base on Facebook.
We do have a big fan base on Facebook. We actually have an insiders group on there and it's a lot of fun in there. People, we've got some hardcore people. We really do.
I love it.
Which is really fun. So our buy sell group was kind of a branch off of that because people would be you know, looking to, you know, swap or sell shoes in there. So we had taken that out of there. And then we decided, we're like, I had thought about it for years, but I was having a really hard time, like, figuring out how to actually manage doing like a pre-loved section on our website. So I finally figured it out of like, okay, well, basically, like, have people submit their stuff. We will list it, like, just using our backend Shopify system. They're going to get 100% of the sale price of that product in store credit. Because that was kind of another thing, was purely from a business standpoint, is like, how do we, because if we're not making money, we're not going to be here. Like, how can we get a little bit more revenue, and ensuring that when people are, you know, selling those shoes, that they're also going to then be coming back and buying from us again. And it has worked really well for us. And it has also been a really great way of getting new customers, because, you know, they might not want to come in and spend $170 on a brand new pair of sneakers, but they might find one their size for $50, $60, $70 in the Root seller. And then, you know, that turns them into a loyal customer. So it really has worked well. It's worked well for our customers too, like people who list their stuff, because now they're getting thousands of eyeballs a month on, you know, the shoe that they're looking to sell. So it really has been, it's been a fun thing. And I'm such a thrifter too. Like, I love shopping secondhand. I'm actually, both my shirt and my pants that I'm wearing right now are secondhand. I love that. I love being able to offer that to our customers.
Yeah, it's so cool. Yeah, I love it. I love it. I love it. I hope more companies will adopt that model. Now, recently you also posted about an incredibly challenging Q4 of 2023. And it's very serious. We've been talking about it here and there. And just thank you for being vulnerable to your community. That's one of the reasons why I love small businesses, is we can be vulnerable. So can you tell us more about the struggles, which I'm sure a lot of small businesses are facing right now, just coming out of last year and COVID and everything? And how can our audience rally around the Root Collective right now?
Yeah, small business has been joking since 2020. Like, we thought that was going to be the worst of it. And then every year, it's just gotten worse. We're like, you know, the new year rolls over and we're like, surely this is the year it's going to get better. And then we're like, no, it's not. It's not getting better. 2023 saw more fair trade and ethical brands go under than I have seen in the 10 plus years that I've been doing this. I mean, it was just like, I felt like constant. Every week I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, y'all are going under too.
Constant.
And we almost did too. I mean, there's multiple times that last year that we were like, well, this is it. we're going under. Yeah, it was just a really challenging year. Just consumer spend was down and, you know, everything's getting more expensive and people have, you know, less money to play with. You know, was it last year that eggs were like insanely expensive? Yeah. I'm like, they're eggs. Why are they so expensive? So it was like, you know, obviously a big part of us understood, you know, people holding on to their money a little bit more. But yeah, it was last summer. I had actually told my team, this is it. Like, we're closing shop. And then a couple things kind of shifted and changed. And that was actually the point where we decided to make some major changes, because we were carrying some shoes in inventory. Like, most everything was pre-order, but like, we had some things in inventory and I was like, you know what, where can we cut costs? Like, what can we do? So like, we did a massive warehouse sale. We got rid of as much inventory as we possibly could. We moved into a smaller space in our warehouse to save money and managed to pull out of it by the skin of our teeth. But it really, last year was tough. And this year, I'm going to say this year is looking on par with last year. You know, we've already seen a couple of the middle of March, a couple of ethical brands have already gone under this year, and it's election year, which is always tough for small business too, just because of, you know, consumer uncertainty. So, I mean, the thing that when people are like, well, what can we do to help? It's like, if you can't shop, I mean, shopping is going to be the number one thing that you can do. Period. For any small business, shopping with them is going to be the number one thing that you can do. But if you can't, it's like a social media post, comment on a social media post, like share a social media post. Like, sharing is a huge thing. Like, people really think that it doesn't make an impact, but you know, the algorithms of social media are terrible. They're terrible. I mean, it's like, people are like, oh, you have 30 plus thousand followers on Instagram. And it's like, yeah. And Instagram shows that to like 300 people, maybe, unless it gets massive engagement on it. And then you will get it shown to other people. But doing stuff like that for a small business is totally free. Totally free for you. And I think that a lot of consumers underestimate how much of an impact they can have just by engaging.
Yeah, love that. So good. As a small business, I agree.
Yeah.
Now, you also made a big decision recently to step away from your B Corp certification, and you chose to be a part of the Fair Trade Federation instead. And you, in fact, you're the newest member of Fair Trade Federation. So welcome to the Fair Trade world officially. Can you tell us about that decision? I'm sure it wasn't easy. Why do you think the Fair Trade Federation is a better fit for your company?
So B Corp has changed a lot. We became a B Corp member very, very early on. And they're actually their process to get certified now versus then, it has very, very clearly become more geared towards bigger businesses. I went through the assessment process, I don't know, like maybe a year or two ago again. And I was like, the stuff that they're asking, I'm like, unless you're like a huge company, or you're working with partners that are already doing this stuff, like it was insane. And Fair Trade Federation started reaching out to us very early on, asking us to join. And this is just a totally frank conversation of, we opted not to because fair trade in the fashion world, those two things do not necessarily mesh. When people hear fair trade in the fashion world, they are assuming it's going to be very crunchy granola, you know, like, they envision hippies and burning incense, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with hippies burning incense, but that's like, you know, for most people, that's not what they want. And that wasn't our brand at all. Yeah. So we had actually opted not to join, but then it was last year. It was last year in the middle of, you know, the world falling apart. I was like, you know what? I really feel like we know that we're doing what we say we're doing. Mm-hmm. But we need that third party verification that says that we are doing what we say that we're doing. Yeah. And so we opted to go through the process, and it was interesting. I mean, it's not easy. It took us a while to get through it, but we were officially members. It was the week of our 10th anniversary.
I just want to say, and I've told you this already, I just want to say, the moment we found out you became a Fair Trade Federation member, it was just like, you guys are a perfect fit. Like, it just makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, it just fit. It just makes sense and it works. So I'm so glad. Yeah. Now we've talked about the beginnings and the challenges and where you are today. And I know you've gone through ups and downs and 10 years mm-hmm. of doing this. What are your hopes, dreams, and your vision for the future of the Root Collective?
My hopes and dreams are, honestly, I want this to be a cult brand. Like, cult status brand has been what I've wanted, and I want it to be stable. You know, like, just being in small business in the last 4 years has just been this roller coaster of emotions. Even before that, you know, I joked every summer we were going out of business, which was not far from the truth. Summer is where small business dreams go to die every year. But I would really just love for us to have like just that, and we already do, like, we have such a dedicated following, but for us to be a more sustainable business, we need that to be a bigger dedicated following. But that's really, you know, I want us to be here 20 years from now.
Yes, definitely. And I want to encourage all of our listeners to go check out the website and let's be part of the cult following.
That's right.
never thought I'd say that, but let's do it. And you are giving our listeners a generous discount, so stick around to the end for that discount code.
Yes.
Now, as we bring our conversation to the end, we always like to end with a fun question. Difficult, maybe, for you. What is your favorite piece from the Root Collective?
Gosh, it is hard. All right, I'm going to give you my current favorite piece.
Okay, I'll take it.
Wait, can I give you two favorites?
I'll take it. Yes. I understand.
All right, because they're two, I would wear them in like two very different scenarios. So our Alex sneaker just came out in the fall of last year, and I wear her constantly. I have them on right now. And those are like my go-to, like every day, like I'm chasing after my 3-year-old, you know, I can mm-hmm. transition from like work to picking my son up from preschool to going to the park to going to the grocery store.
Yeah.
And I know I'm going to be super comfortable. So I really love that. But a shoe called the Audrey, which is a square toe, low heel sandal. Mm. Oh, I love it. I love it. So like the heel height is perfect. And it's super cute. And I always feel so chic when I'm wearing it. So they're like, mm-hmm. the Alex and the Audrey are two very, very different shoes that I would wear in mm-hmm. very different situations. But I would say those are my two current favorites.
Mm, I love it. Perfect. Now this season, we also want to end every episode by asking our guests this question. How do you stay hopeful on this journey? It's certainly not easy running a small business, especially through the challenging years recently. What is a tip, a practice, or a mindset you could share that can help us stay hopeful in this journey of creating a better world?
I would say there's two things that I do with that. First one is prayer. I mean, I spend a lot of time talking to Jesus. Mm-hmm. And that's my sanity for sure. But also the relationships that I have, you know, I've got a couple, one of my closest friends is also in the fair trade world. And, you know, I think being able to have that kind of camaraderie with somebody who understands and who gets it really helps me stay grounded, because it's like, I mean, even if you run a product-based business, if you're not doing it from a fair trade perspective, it's very different. It is very, very different. And so having those relationships with people who really get it, to me, has been a game changer.
Mm. Community. It's so important. The right community.
Yeah.
Oh, this was so good. Thank you so much for sharing all your knowledge and wisdom. Yeah. And I want to see the Root Collective continue on and bring sustainable fair trade shoes to the world. So
let's
all go support. All right. Thank you so much, Bethany.
Yes. Thank you, Alicia. I'm so glad I could be here.
Thank you.
Wow. I have a newfound appreciation for shoes. And more than that, this conversation was an important reminder to think about the people who make our shoes. Shoes are an important investment for ourselves and our overall physical health, but it is also an important investment in the makers and the communities that it impacts. We really do hold so much purchasing power, and we get to decide how we can impact the world through the shoes we wear. Bethany is generously giving our listeners 20% off their entire site at therootcollective.com. Just use promo code FairTradeLA, that's FairTradeLA. They have so many gorgeous options. I love the sneakers and the heels. I don't know how I'm going to pick. But together, let's support this fair trade shoe company and help spread the word. As always, the details will be in our show notes at fairtradela.org/podcast. Until next time, bye for now. I want to thank the creative team behind the Fair Talks podcast, our executive producer, Juliette Bucurel, our editor, Kaden Sullivan, our marketing team, Jasmine French, Elena Alcero, and Lizzie Case. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Fair Talks podcast. Thank you for being a part of our community and sharing the fair trade message. Thank you again to our sponsor, Fairtrade USA, for making this possible. Now, are you ready to create change? The next time you're out shopping, just pick up one fair trade item to buy, like coffee, chocolate, or bananas, and make a difference. Ask your office, church, business, school, or your family to shop more fair. If you have any questions or want to learn more, head over to fairtradela.org/podcast for show notes, discount codes, and additional resources. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode. And follow us on social media at FairTradeLA to join our amazing community of fair trade lovers. Tune into our next Fair Talks conversation to hear more life-changing stories. Thanks for listening.